Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show. This is your host, Jason Hartman, where we talk about protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in these uncertain times. We have a great interview for you today, and we will be back with that in less than 60 seconds on the Holistic Survival Show. And by the way, be sure to visit our website at holisticsurvival.com. You can subscribe to our blog, which is totally free, has loads of great information, and there's just a lot of good content for you on the site. So make sure you take advantage of that at holisticsurvival.com. We'll be right back. It's my pleasure to welcome Michael Cosgrove to the show. He is the author of Imperfect Passage, and we're going to hear some amazing things about his long, long journey on a sailboat all the way from Southern California to Auckland, New Zealand, way down under there. And there are some good life lessons here that we'll hear, and I'm anxious to hear them directly from him. Michael, welcome. How are you?
Thank you, Jason. I'm wonderful, and thanks for having me on. I love your show.
Well, thank you. It's funny what a small world it is, Michael, because you have a home in Irvine, California, where I lived for many years, and then right now you're coming to us from a beautiful lakeside home in northern Michigan, right?
That's our summer getaway, yes. We call it Camp Cosgrove, and we entertain our 11 grandchildren here during the summer, so it's a wonderful change from Orange County.
Good, good stuff. Well, hey, what inspired you to jump in a sailboat and leave San Diego and attempt to sail around the world? I mean, what the heck?
Well, it all started on my 60th birthday. I cruised past 40 and 50 without even looking back. Then at 60, we were living in Laguna Beach at the time, looking out over Bluebird Canyon, beautiful view of the Pacific Ocean from Dana Point to Palos Verdes. When it came time to open presents, I pulled my youngest grandson, Alexander, up on my lap. And the first present he opened was a dozen Titleist golf balls. And I said, without thinking, Alexander, when you're 20, we're going to play a lot of golf together. And Jason, it was as if a lightning bolt hit me. And that lightning bolt said, when Alexander's 20, you're going to be 82 years old. Now, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? You have 15, 20 years of good life left. What do you want to do with it? Boy, I thought about finishing my PhD, buying another Harley, learning a foreign language, but nothing worked. I needed to leave a legacy for my grandchildren. And I had been sailing for about 30 years, up and down the coast pretty much, but I decided that a dream of 30 years ago of sailing around the world was feasible now after raising four children, paying for four college educations and four weddings. Now it was my turn. So I bought a bigger boat and headed out of San Diego to fulfill the dream of sailing around the world, never having sailed out of sight of land before. So that's what motivated me to go.
How big was the boat?
The boat was 40 feet long.
Okay.
And it was a good ocean-going boat.
Uh-huh. What kind of boat was it?
It was a Bayfield 40 designed by Ted Gozzard. It was well-equipped to go across the oceans. I wasn't. Having never been out there before, I didn't really know what I was getting into.
So how long did you sail before this?
I had sailed about 30 years up and down the coast and on inland lakes, but I'd never gone out of sight of land. So that was the difference, really. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. So this was a pretty big attempt at age 60 to do this kind of thing. What were some of the things that happened to you on the trip, and what did you learn from those experiences?
Well, I took on a crew member. I wanted to go alone, but I took on a crew member in the beginning. I didn't know the guy. I took him out of founding in a newspaper. And he turned out to have a personality disorder. And about halfway to Hawaii, he said, Michael, you don't deserve this boat. It should be mine. And he threatened to hit me over the head with a winch handle and take my boat.
Out in the middle of the ocean, he did this, huh?
Out in the middle of the ocean, yeah. And so I was able to talk him out of it. It was like a 2,000-mile therapy session. but I have a master's degree in psychology, and that really helped. I had saved a lot of people or helped save a lot of people from suicide. Now it's my turn to save myself from this crazy guy. But one of the biggest surprises to me was the psychological impact that being in the middle of the ocean has on one's total being. On shore, we're in control of our environment. We turn up the heat if we're cold. We change the channel if we don't like the program. On the ocean, you lose all your control. The weather and the conditions determine where you go, how fast you go, when you eat, when you sleep. So that had a tremendous effect on my psyche, just trying to adapt to losing all of my power, all of my control. So that was the first challenge, I guess, was trying to get a grip on the environment, on the condition.
And so getting a grip on the condition and the environment, you had this basic mutiny with this guy that was threatening to kill you out in the middle of the ocean, where you had no recourse, nothing, no one could help you. Pretty amazing. What else happened?
Well, talking about survival, being on the ocean and out of control, having no control, the first thing you have to get a grip on is your attitude, your psychological state. Is if you don't take care of yourself, you're going to have a lot of trouble trying to work under very difficult conditions like sleep deprivation. You can't eat when you want to eat, foul weather, storms. You need to realize that you can't change the direction of the wind, but you can adjust your sails.
And that is a great quote. Is 'tis the set of the sails, not the gales, that determines the direction of the ship, I believe is how that one goes.
That's very good. Was that
Thomas Carlyle that said that, maybe? I can't remember.
I don't know. I don't know for sure, but it speaks to the fact that you have to have your attitude in control. And then another one is you need to know the difference between a temporary inconvenience and a real problem. Sometimes a squall, a storm, is nothing more than a temporary inconvenience. But when I was between New Caledonia and Australia, I lost my autopilots. I had to hand steer the boat for about 800 miles.
And how long does it take to go 800 miles, hand steering?
Well, my average speed was 4.2 knots. So about 100 miles a day was a good day. You can walk faster than what I sail.
I mean, how could you possibly steer the boat yourself for 8 days? I mean, how, you had to sleep somewhere in there.
When between storms, I would sleep 15 minutes at a time with the helm kind of tied down. I'd lash it down, sleep 15 minutes at a time. But knowing the difference between a temporary inconvenience and a real problem helps. And it's also darn near impossible to do well what you don't do often. I had never sailed out there on the open ocean. And I don't care if it's solving complex math problems or hitting a golf ball or making love to your wife. If you don't do it often, you're probably not going to do it well. So that was one of my big mistakes. I didn't know what I was doing in the middle of the ocean. During cyclone season, I would fly back to Orange County. And after making the first passage to Hawaii, I was done with the boat. I wanted to walk away from it. I wanted to have a delivery boat take it back to San Diego and sell it. Well, once I got home and recovered and the bed stopped moving and from the motion of the ocean, I realized that I had an opportunity of a lifetime and that I had to go back to sea. Even though I missed my wife, I missed my grandkids, and it was very difficult conditions. But when I die and they spread my ashes, I don't want there to be any regrets in the box. I didn't want to be 82 years old sitting in my leather recliner watching a football game thinking, could have been, would have been, should have been, oh, I should have sailed on to Bora Bora. Why didn't I go? So I went back to sea and sailed on.
So, you know, when you say you have to distinguish a temporary inconvenience from a real problem, that's a good point, you know, not making a mountain out of a molehill, just getting through something that's a temporary challenge. But you also mentioned managing one's attitude. And really, I think that's very important to survival situations. The most important survival tool is the one between your ears, obviously. How do you manage your attitude, though? Can you give any steps to doing that? It's sort of easy to say that, but are there any tips on actually how to implement it?
Boy, it doesn't come naturally. It doesn't come naturally. You have to work at it. Just as if you wanted to run a marathon, You've got to get yourself in shape to do that. Well, for me, it was a daily process of working on my head, keeping it straight. And many mornings when I wake up, well, I subscribe to a program of self-motivation. That's what I like to call it. And many mornings before I get out of bed, I'm going to say, Michael, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Yesterday is but a memory. Tomorrow is but a dream. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. Now you can either choose to use it or lose it. The choice is yours. Your only limitation will be your imagination. Go get them, Michael. That helps to realize that it's within my control.
Okay, so the realization of knowing what's in your control and what's not in your control, definitely an important thing. It's kind of like the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi, accept the things you cannot change, just deal with them, in other words.
Oh, boy, that's a big one.
Yeah, yeah. Any comments on that?
Yes. Know what you can control. Know what's out of your control. Don't beat your head against a brick wall. Don't swim upstream. Accept what you can't control and try to make the best of it. And that helps also, yes. Jason, it helps to know that the relationship between expectation and reality can be devastating to one's total being without a healthy perspective. So maintain that perspective and keep your priorities straight. Know what comes first and what comes second. And don't beat your head against the wall trying to change what you can't change.
Very good point. What else happened on the trip? You had the mutiny. I mean, I think that's probably the scariest. I don't know. Was that scarier, the problem of, you know, man, or was nature scarier? What was the scarier problem? I'm wondering.
I could fight against my crew member if I had to, but when I was without an autopilot, hand steering the boat, and storms would blow up off the Southern Ocean. I was in the Northern Tasman Sea at the time. It was very difficult to fight the storms because they're so totally controlling. How do you fight the storm? You can't. There's no place to hide, no place to run. You've got to shorten your sails, adjust your sails, and sleep deprivation is one of the biggest challenges, one of the most frightening aspects of being on the ocean alone. You can't sleep, you can't eat, and so you've got to work on your attitude constantly and be as positive as possible. Do what you can to survive. And I thought about my wife, my grandchildren, and I had to get home. Well, during that storm, I realized that leaving a legacy for my grandchildren by being gone for 3 or 4 years wasn't the kind of legacy I wanted to leave, that the love of my family, the love of my grandchildren, was more important than sailing around the world, which was kind of ego-based, I thought, at that point. So that's why I gave it up in New Zealand, because I'd rather spend birthdays with grandchildren or go to my granddaughter's soccer game on Saturday morning and leave a legacy in that sense.
Sure, sure. But, you know, I'm curious, when you gave it up in New Zealand, how do you end the trip with a sailboat? I mean, who did you bring the boat back? Did the boat come back?
Yeah, well, how did you kind of. there's a company that runs a dry dock ship. They pull it into port. They open the bells, fills with water. You sail your boat onto the ship. They put it in a cradle. The boat empties the water, and it came back on a ship.
How much does that cost? That must cost a fortune, I would assume.
Yes, it was. It was about $12,000.
But they brought your boat back, and they brought it back to, I guess, San Diego or Newport?
Actually, I had them deliver it to Vancouver, British Columbia, and I got on it there and went up the Inland Passage towards Alaska for a couple of months.
Well, that's an adventure. Yeah.
Oh, it's a beautiful country.
Yeah, it sure is.
But, you know, Jason, I sailed over 12,000 miles, and I was never more than 3 miles from land, straight down, straight below my boat. In all actuality, many, many times I was over 1,000 miles from land, and I never wore a life jacket when I was alone, because if I fell off the boat, having a life jacket on would only prolong the inevitable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, did you harness yourself to the boat, though?
Yes, I did harness myself to the boat.
What would have happened had you fallen asleep, say, during a storm when the autopilot wasn't working, And say you were just, even with a storm, you couldn't have woken up. I mean, at some point, your body's just going to shut down and sleep, I assume. What could have happened? Would the boat capsize? I mean, did you just rib the sails, or did you, you know, or did you completely, you drop the sails, right? I mean, the boat would just go around in the storm. I mean, would it turn over? Would it run into something? I mean, you know, what's the exact danger there?
I was in a storm on the way to Australia, and it blew 62 miles an hour. The seas were 24 feet tall. If I would have let go of the helm, it would have laid beam to the seas, and we would have capsized.
Yeah, yes. Wow. Oh, boy, that's just unbelievable. What about, you know, when your autopilot went out, did you think of calling a rescue? I mean, that 16-year-old girl, that the story of her, I can't remember her name now, but her parents let her leave, I think, San Diego, and, you know, after about 8,000 miles, I believe it was, she finally called rescue, and they came to get her out in the middle of that ocean. But why didn't you call a rescue? Did you think of it, or, I mean, you couldn't do it, or what happened?
I had a satellite phone on board with me, and I called my wife and asked her to call friends that we had in Australia and ask them to alert the Australian Coast Guard and see if they could come assist me. And the word we got back was that I was too far from, I was 800 miles from Australia, too far for them to attempt a rescue at that point, because actually the boat was still floating and I was doing okay. So maybe if the boat was sinking, we could have gotten somebody out of New Caledonia or Fiji or someplace to come help. But no, I was pretty much on my own.
Unbelievable. That's just crazy. Hey, one more thing I want to ask you before you go. Any survival tools or equipment or things that you were really glad that you had and how you use them and things that were missing? I mean, maybe a spare autopilot that you could have replaced. That was probably missing.
Yeah, actually, I had two, and they both died.
They both just died. How do they die, by the way? What happens to them? I mean,
well, in corrosion, chafing, and water, seawater, knocks out the electronics. And corrosion can't cluttered up the mechanism on the backup self-steering gear. But before I left, I bought 300 MREs, meals ready to eat. And they're very convenient. I just bought the entrees. And my daughter, number two daughter, Carrie, who had just spent 4 years in the Army, said, "Dad, you bought MREs? Do you know what we used to call those?" I said, "No, Carrie, what do you call them?" And she said, "Meals rejected by Ethiopians."
That's pretty good.
But I would lash the helm down, run below, grab an MRE, grab a small bag of instant rice, come back, grab the helm, put one of the MREs under my fall weather, inside my fall weather jacket in my armpit, the rice in the other armpit, and I'd leave them there for about 30 minutes, hoping that they would get warmed up, pull out the MRE, rip the top off with my teeth, squirt in some, get the rice, squirt in some rice, and chew. That was one piece of equipment or provision that was really helpful, because it was very difficult to prepare anything. So I haven't eaten an MRE since, and I don't think I ever will.
Okay, so MREs were handy, though. Those came in handy for sure. Anything
yeah.
else, other equipment
yeah.
or survival tools?
EPIRP, an emergency locator that if it had gotten wet, it would send out a GPS emergency beacon signal to alert Coast Guard and rescue people around the world. It's called an EPIRP.
But the Australian Coast Guard wouldn't rescue you because you were too far. So would that have even mattered?
If the boat would have capsized, they would have launched a rescue mission. But without the boat being, or without me, what they thought would be classified as immediate danger, they wouldn't come out. But if the EPIRP would have sounded, they would. The safety harness was invaluable, being able to clamp in and stay on the boat. The dinghy and the life raft were very helpful. I wouldn't go out there without a life raft that was provisioned. Fortunately, I never had to launch it, but those were two items that were very helpful.
Well, hey, tell people where they can get the book, and if you have a website of your own, please give that out.
Yeah, sure, thanks. My website is Michael Cosgrove, CosGrove.com, and the book's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. I really like independent bookstores, so if you'd like to buy a hard copy, they're available at independent bookstores. And thank you very much, Jason.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming on the show. Michael Cosgrove, author of Imperfect Passage. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
What's great about the shows you'll find on jasonhartman.com is that if you want to learn how to finance your next big real estate deal, there's a show for that. If you want to learn more about food storage and the best way to keep those onions from smelling up everything else, there's a show for that. If you honestly want to know more about business ethics, there's a show for that. And if you just want to get away from it all and need to know something about world travel, there's even a show for that. Yep, there's a show for just about anything. Only from jasonhartman.com or type in Jason Hartman in the iTunes store.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed.